Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump took to the floor of the United Nations General Assembly this week for the first time. And in his speech, he focused on the threat posed by North Korea, referring to the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, as Rocket Man.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary.
The president also took aim at Iran's nuclear ambitions, calling the Iran deal negotiated by his predecessor, Barack Obama, an embarrassment. This hour, it's all politics in and around Washington with one of the best in the business, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Ken will be joining All Sides every Thursday of the month, so mark your calendars. Welcome back, Ken Rudin.
Good morning, Ann. Glad to be back.
Donald Trump is nothing if not predictable in how he tends to bring his confrontational style to every facet of his job, including what's arguably the biggest stage in the world.
Well, I don't know if predictable is the word I would use. I mean, we were preparing for bombast and America first kind of language, but the thought of talking about destroying another nation at the UN, I mean, that's just beyond the thought of any other president in the world saying that. And of course, there was a lot of focus on the Rocket Man, that cartoonish caricature of the leader of North Korea. Mm-hmm. But this is not a joke. This is not a cartoon. We're talking about the future of the world here. And to talk in such childish terms, well, yes, it is vintage Trump. But of course, if you took a look at some of the faces of the Americans who were part of the delegation, they may not have been as happy as Trump supporters may have been.
I did look at them. What did you make of it?
Well, I mean, you know, it's. I mean, obviously, a lot has. I'm watching Nikki Haley, and I'm watching Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, mm-hmm. and of course, I couldn't tell from their faces, but I've read many accounts that they were warned. The president was urged over and over again, please don't refer to Rocket Man. I mean, it's one thing to do it in a tweet. It's one thing to get his Twitter followers to be amused. And of course, there are so many Twitter followers of Donald Trump who love everything he says. Mm-hmm. But to say it before a world body of all these nations who were trying to survive, spend their time in office surviving to the next day. It's much more important than the president seemed to indicate with his kind of loose language.
China didn't exit before Trump arrived, as did Korea and Iran, but afterward seemed to take the high road and is getting a lot of credit for saying, gently reminding the world that the Korean Peninsula is a complicated place.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's one thing talking about destroying a country when, of course, any destruction of North Korea or any kind of attack on North Korea would be tremendous implications for China. There would be tons of refugees. Not only would there be tons of refugees moving north into China, which China doesn't seem to be ready to handle, mm-hmm. but of course, if South Korea became the dominant force in the Korean Peninsula, well, the last thing China wants is a U.S. ally on its doorstep. So talking about whether China is doing all it can, there are tremendously important implications for what China decides. And I guess I think that was part of what we saw from China. It showed that they are at least the adult in the room, at least as of this point.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You probably recognize this familiar voice, Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken will be joining us the third Thursday of every month from now on. We're so happy to have a regular opportunity to chat with Ken. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there as well.
I think the last time on your show, Soviet missiles were heading towards Cuba and President Kennedy had put up this quarantine. It's been a long time since I've been on your show.
I know it has. I mean, I'm trying to think when you were on last. It was maybe something a year ago-ish or so, maybe.
Probably, yeah.
Maybe
within a year, yes.
Post, yeah. I know, it was post or pre-election for at least a segment. a little bit of time.
And we were preparing for President Hillary Clinton. It was a done deal.
Somewhat.
We all knew it would happen.
Well, it was the conventional wisdom, and of course, we're coming up on a year anniversary of the Trump administration now.
Well, certainly the nomination, right? I mean, he's only been in office 8 months. Is it only 8 months?
Yeah.
Coming up on 9 months, but my goodness, you know, you could talk about, well, you know, the Republicans haven't accomplished that much since Trump has been in office, but my goodness, you almost have to catch your breath each day. Nobody could ever say that politics is boring. It may be frustrating and destructive at times, but it's certainly not boring.
Well, it certainly is part of what's behind us asking you to come back on a regular basis and investing in this, because it's what people are talking about on a daily basis, it seems like.
Well, I'm thrilled to do this. You know how I feel about WOSU. You know, we've come out when we would talk with The Nation, and when I was with NPR, we would come out and do these great events for the Columbus audience. You have a very loyal and great fan base, and I'm thrilled to be back with you on the air, Ann.
Oh, man. So what next? I mean, the first time I think we ever started talking about Donald Trump was probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, yes, I mean, of course, in 2000, he was talking about running for president on the Reform Party ticket because he hated Republicans and he hated Democrats. And if you look at the last 8 months or 9 months of his presidency, or the entire bit of his presidency, he still seems to hate Democrats and Republicans. He does have his allies at a certain point in time, but every time it looks like he's saying nice things about Republicans, he can stab them and just in the back, and just the same thing with Democrats. Donald Trump is unlike anybody we've ever seen in politics, let alone a president. And, you know, he is always the art of the deal, and whether it benefits Republicans or Democrats, he doesn't seem to care. He does care if a deal is done. And so when it comes to, you know, the raising the debt ceiling or a tax system or the budget or even health care, I think he doesn't really cares as much about the details as he cares about getting something accomplished. And that's what's coming up actually next week with this big vote on health care.
Right. Exactly. What do you think, you know, it's been about 8 months. What do you think works for him? How does he work best? What are his methods that seem to resonate with the people he has to work with in Washington? Have you found any?
Well, you know something, I don't know what is working. I think if you talk to his supporters, they'll say that things are working. It's just that you have this belligerent press and a belligerent Congress, including Republican leaders, who are out or stopping him. I mean, there are a lot of Trump supporters who have as much disdain, if not more disdain, for people like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan than they do for Democrats. So I don't think that the supporters look at Democrats or Republicans. I think that they just look at what helps Donald Trump. And for all the things that he's tried to accomplish, I mean, he's lost. He's gotten rid of many. There was a picture early in the administration where you see a picture of Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort and Sean Spicer and all these people sitting around together talking, and they're all gone. And it seems like he's gotten rid of a lot of key members of his administration because he believes in, well, maybe it's a one-way loyalty, but if you're not loyal, if you don't follow the Trump line, you're gone. Now, as far as loyalty, you can make the case that there are a lot of Republicans who have been loyal to him, and he may not have been loyal in return. But again, he wants his success. He knows that a report card comes out from the media all the time, and he wants to do better, get better marks than he's getting right now. I think the tweets work for him because he reaches out to his key supporters. But, you know, as far as legislation, as far as relationships with our allies around the world, the grade is still, you know, it's still out.
He hasn't been trashing the media as much lately.
Well, I wonder if that has to do with John Kelly. John Kelly is the new chief of staff. And, of course, he's trying to limit the amount of tweeting the president has done. And actually, the president has not been as visible on Twitter as he had in the past. But still, even as we were approaching when he was about to go down to Florida for Texas for Hurricane Harvey, The day before he left, he said something about something snide about Hillary Clinton. So, he, you know, for Democrats who, for people who keep saying that Hillary Clinton hasn't gotten over her defeat yet, and I don't know why she could ever, how she could ever get over that defeat, President Trump doesn't seem to have been gotten over the election either, even though he won, even though he is the president. But I guess the fact that she got a majority of the vote, the fact that the media still seems to be in her corner, certainly not in his corner, that just rankles him and he just can't get over it.
Here's an email from Debbie. She said, Ken, I love it when you are on Ann's show. Thanks, Debbie. If senators, she says, if Senators Murkowski, McCain and Collins change to independents and caucus with the Democrats, would the Democrats then take control of the Senate? First of all, what are the odds that Senators Murkowski, McCain and Collins would switch from the Republican Party?
Zero. But I mean,
exactly.
But, you know, the last time this happened, of course, was in 2001 when Senator Jim Jeffords, a lifelong Republican from Vermont, didn't like the way the Bush administration, the new Bush administration, was dealing with issues such as, you know, spending and health care and things like that. And he became an independent. So it became, instead of a 50-50 Senate, which gave Dick Cheney, the vice president, the tie-breaking vote and gave Republicans control, Jeffords didn't become a Democrat, but he became an independent voting with the Democrats. And for a brief time, the Democrats got control of the Senate, although that disappeared with the 2002 election. So in other words, if they did switch, it would give the Democrats a majority in the Senate, but they don't have to. All they have to do, I mean, if you want to please the Democrats and please people who believe in the kind of health care that the Affordable Care Act presented, then Murkowski, Collins, and McCain have to do what they did back in July, and that is vote next week, and the deadline is September 30th, to vote next week against the so-called Graham-Cassidy bill, which is in many ways more detrimental to many people than the previous incarnations of healthcare. So they're not going to switch parties, but their votes will be very crucial.
Right. Murkowski looks to be at the crux of that. I want to talk about that a little bit more in a second. But first, again, you know, the president, it seems the president does better during private conversations. And how about that dinner with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi? NPR reported this morning, The Washington Post and others last week, that the heart and soul of the Democratic Party is wary, if not downright repulsed, by their willingness to engage with the president. Pelosi says it doesn't matter. She's a classic wheeler dealer. What about it? Does it matter?
Well, it's funny. You know, you think of all the Republicans who get heck when they go home and meet their constituents. There was a rally last week in California with Nancy Pelosi, and activists from the left, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, pilloried her for working with President Trump, especially on DACA and the Dreamers, and saying that you can't negotiate the future of these Dreamers by tying it in with, like, for example, border security. I mean, we are human beings, and you can't play political games. And so, you know, these progressives will definitely take their ire out on fellow Democrats as much as they would against Republicans.
But it's not just in California. It's in New York. It happened to be on this particular issue. Do you think this is about the only issue that they can negotiate with them on at all anyway?
Well, you never know with Donald Trump. You never know if he really wants to work with Chuck and Nancy, his two best friends, as he calls them, Chuck and Nancy, or he just wants to stick it to the Republicans. The fact is that the Republicans have been talking about not 7 months, but 7 years about repealing the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obamacare, and they weren't able to do it, certainly when they had their opportunities, given the fact that they have majorities in the House and Senate. Donald Trump is saying, well, look, if the Republicans can't do it, you know, I'll just work with somebody who can. So for all the, we're so used to seeing all these divisive issues over the raising the debt ceiling and coming together with a budget. He said, if the Republicans can't get their act together, I'll work with the Democrats, which makes me think that it's a strong possibility that Donald, and given the fact that you have so many Republicans not in Donald Trump's camp, led by John Kasich, for example, the governor of Ohio, among others, I wonder if Donald Trump, seeking re-election in 2020, will say, look, a pox on both your houses. I'll just run as an independent. Let the Republicans put up a candidate. Let the Democrats put up a candidate. I'll run as an independent. And with his money and guaranteed funding, I could see him winning re-election that way, even though obviously an independent candidate for president has never come close to winning, except maybe Teddy Roosevelt back in 1912.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, of course, is Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. We'll get to some more questions by phone. If you would like to join us, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@WOSU.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question there. Again, All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Senate Republicans are pushing a last-ditch effort to undo the Affordable Care Act. They have until the end of the month to pass the measure with just 50 votes. Vice President Mike Pence would cast that tie-breaking vote. After September, 60 votes will be needed for passage. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham defended his proposal.
So here's the choice for America: socialism or federalism when it comes to your health care. Four states get 40% of the money under Obamacare. New York, California, Massachusetts, and Maryland, they represent 20% of the population. Our goal is by 2026 to make sure that every patient in every state gets the same contribution roughly from the federal government and allow people in your states to make decisions that would have been made in Washington.
We're talking politics and political policy this hour with veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Once again, Ken will be joining All Sides every third Thursday of the month, so mark your calendars. Ken Rudin, the Graham-Cassidy bill that would repeal and replace most of Obamacare with a block grant program seemed to come out of nowhere fast. It's the ultimate last-ditch effort, right?
Well, you know, that's what's so amazing. I mean, Lindsey Graham is making this a life and death choice here. And for many people, it may be life and death. But a week ago, this bill didn't exist. Somehow the Republicans suddenly realized that under their reconciliation rules, that they can pass something like this with 50 votes. Remember, Obamacare needed 60 votes to pass back in 2009 and 2010. But because of the way they wrote the rules here, the Republicans can pass it under reconciliation with 50 votes, but they only have until the end of the fiscal year, September 30th. So some Republican must have said, oh my goodness, we only have a week or so. Let's come up with a bill fast. And for many people, for many Republicans like Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and John McCain, the three Republicans who voted no back in July, they're saying, is this bill any better than it was? Because it still has massive cuts in Medicaid. And it penalizes states that rely so much on the expanded Medicaid funding, which Ohio is certainly one of them. Mm-hmm. Far fewer numbers of Americans would be covered under this bill. And as you say, they have these state-by-state block grants that these states can pick and choose and decide how to spend this money. So it won't have as many people covered. Premiums and things like that could get much more expensive. And it becomes political. And they just say, like, I don't know if this is the greatest bill in the world, but we know we have to pass it by September 30th. Right now, I don't think they have the 50 votes. Yes, Mike Pence will be hanging close by in D.C. if he has to break a tie. But not only are the votes of Murkowski, McCain, and Collins thought to be up in the air, but Rand Paul, the conservative from Kentucky, says this bill is really Obamacare light. I don't see any difference with it, and I'm going to vote no. And then you also have people like Rob Portman of Ohio and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. They know that their states could very well suffer with this new block grant proposal, and so their votes are questioned as well. And of course, you have governors like John Kasich, who's saying, oh no, this is a bad bill. You have the independent governor of Alaska who is saying, no, vote no on this. And of course, Murkowski, Lisa Murkowski, is listening to them as well. So Yes, the deadline, it's amazing. We thought this was, you know, the dead and gone forever. But, you know, in forever, in Washington, forever could last only 1 week. And remember, there's a lot of people who think that the Republicans could pick up more Senate seats in 2018, given the fact that 25 of the 33 seats up are Democrats, and many of them are Democrats who ran and won in Trump states. So if the Republicans could gain more seats in 2018, I'm sure another health care bill would come up in 2019 should this one fail.
Here is co-sponsor Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana on how the bill would affect states.
If you're in a state which has not expanded Medicaid, you're going to do great. And all those lower-income Texans, Floridians, Mainers, Virginians, Missourians will have dollars in their state to help them get health insurance that they currently do not have. If you're a state which has expanded Medicaid, we do our best to hold you harmless. We don't want to hurt folks.
It looks like a red state, blue state breakdown, frankly, or at least I'm getting a lot of different reads on whether the makeup of the proposed grant program in general rewards those states that didn't fully participate in the Affordable Care Act and punishes those states, including Ohio, that did.
Well, I don't know if it's red states, blue states, because how would you describe Ohio? I always thought of Ohio as a kind of a purple state, even though it did go for Donald Trump in 2016.
It went for Donald Trump. It's Republican all the way up and down the line, except for
that's
like,
true. But it also voted for Barack Obama twice in 2008 right. and 2012.
And of course, there's New York.
And this red exactly, but of course there are states like New York and California that embraced the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of Medicaid into their states from the beginning, and they will absolutely suffer. But I don't think that Graham and Cassidy, I'm not trying to be snide about this, but you know they don't really care. I'm not saying they don't care about anybody, but they're talking about states like Texas, like Louisiana, like Florida, which do have Republican gut. Well. Let me take it back again. Louisiana has a Democratic governor. Mm-hmm. So I think it may be either conservative or liberal or more likely states that have not embraced Obamacare and the expansion of Medicaid. Those states will benefit. Those that have embraced it and expanded Medicaid will suffer.
Let's see.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
I know I'm just. I was listening to Terry Gross's commercial, talking about Ken Burns and the Vietnam special during the break. Mm-hmm. My goodness, if everybody's seen it, this is must see TV. Yeah. I know for some people, Vietnam is like the Boer War. You know, it happened a gazillion years ago. But those of us old people, not me or you, but other people who are old. Vietnam was our youth, was our lives, was the fear that we grew up with. This is the most riveting television, aside from This Is Us, but this is the most riveting television I've seen in years. It is just fantastic stuff, and PBS should be very proud.
Are you watching the unedited version?
Oh, no, I didn't even know that exists.
There is one.
Who wins that war?
I don't know. Well, it's the same outcome, but a lot more graphic. You know, it's just a lot more of everything. It's fantastic. I mean,
it's graphic the way it is, and it's just it's just heart wrenching. And on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, if I can mention a plug on the show that went up this morning. One of the guests on the show is Sam Brown, who was the head of the Vietnam Moratorium Committee in 1969, and he talks about what it was like trying to run anti-war rallies and protests around the country in those amazing days of 67, 68, and 69. It's just riveting and heart-wrenching.
It's fantastic. I interviewed Ken Rudin and Lynn Novick.
Is Ken Rudin anyway?
Ken Burns. God, I know. Okay. You know, I do this stuff all the time, and I only can depend on people like you, Ken, to make sure I get corrected. I think I was talking about red and white states yesterday with something like, well,
and
yeah,
blue.
All right,
red
and
blue
states. Whatever.
We are all Americans. Okay, we are one America, as John Edwards used to say.
Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is the most watched holdout on the issue of the Graham Cassidy bill. What sort of pressure must she be under, or do you think she can handle it?
I think she can handle it because remember during the July vote, President Trump singled her out by name and there was a lot of pressure on her by members of the Trump administration saying, if you vote no, you know, they'll be held to bay. We won't give Alaska, you know, X, Y, or Z funding. Mm-hmm. And she says, you're not going to bully me on this. And it seems like she has been spared that kind of personal bullying, but she is under tremendous pressure. Every time you see her walking down the Senate hall, she is surrounded by scores of reporters. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And she says, I'm going to do what's best for Alaska. And as I said earlier, you did hear that from the independent governor of Alaska who said this is bad for the state. I don't know how she's going to vote, but I suspect she's going to vote no, but I will watch her vote through my, because I could see her vote through my kitchen window. It's amazing how you could do that with Alaska.
Let's see. Hal in German Village, you're on the air with Ken Rudin.
Good morning, Ken. It's good to hear your voice again.
Thank you, Hal.
Well, first of all, I was in Vietnam in 59, and you're right. I watched that tragedy unfold. And it was something that should probably have never happened, at least the way that it did. Back to my concern, though. I see more Chinese students in this country than ever before. I see more trade with China. I see all kinds of scientific and other exchange and cooperations like the space station with Russia. And the only place that I really see all this noise, this political noise and all this political drama, is in politics. And it doesn't look like politics is leading. It looks like politics is off on a tangent someplace. So I'm trying to reconcile this inconsistency that I see. And I'm wondering, is the public just simply being distracted by the political sector and the media because there are so many other things that they don't want to do? I'm not sure what's going on here.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think a lot of Americans and people in the government are not sure what to do either. Because remember, when Donald Trump was running for president, he really talked about better relations with Russians and tried to tamp down the antagonism and the tension. Remember when Mitt Romney during the 2012 debates talked about how Russia was the worst enemy, you know, the most dangerous and fearsome enemy to the United States. Obama made a joke, like a sarcastic crack, saying, well, we're going to have the Cold War all over again. But the point is, Russia and China have strategic aims around the country. We saw this with Russia and Crimea and Ukraine. So we could talk about cooperation and space stations and trade and all those things, but there are political differences not only coming from the Trump administration, but you could just see it from the actions of China and Russia that it's just, you know, it's things are complicated. You could say that Iran is, you know, whatever you think of Iran, for example. I mean, Iran is not a nation, bunch of nice guys. I mean, they are fermenting revolution and supporting Hezbollah and Hamas and things like that. But at the same time, they seem to be adhering to the deal that was signed in 2015. So they all have their own issues. They all have their own interests. But at the same time, many of the countries we're talking about do care about world stability. And there is a contradiction. You're absolutely right.
Hal, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Good to hear Ken again.
Thank you, Ed.
For the podcast. Listen, the question I have is, what will it take for the Democrats to win back at least the Senate? And secondarily, is Hillary Clinton and her apology tour actually holding back the Democrats advancing their agenda? And I'll listen on the air.
Okay. Can the Democrats retake the Senate? And how is the news about Hillary Clinton's book and her, as he called it, an apology tour affecting that?
Or the blame tour. I mean, it's interesting. I'm fascinated about Hillary Clinton's book. On, I had Jennifer Palmieri, her communications director, on the show a few weeks ago. And there's some things in the book that Jennifer liked and didn't like. Look, She's stunned like so many of her supporters were stunned. Not only did we think that Hillary Clinton was going to win, I personally thought she was going to win the day of the election. It's not so, I mean, that's how far off we were. But there were a lot of things she did wrong. I mean, we've talked about this a lot. I mean, aside from the strange answers about the emails and the Clinton Foundation, the fact that she didn't campaign in states like Wisconsin, for example, didn't even go there after the convention, while she focused on states like Arizona, which she wasn't, or Texas or Georgia, which she wasn't going to win. So she made some, she certainly made mistakes. And people say, well, it's a blame everybody else tour, and she blames James Comey and the media and misogyny and Russian. But let's be honest here. If James Comey didn't announce 11 days before the election that we're going to look into her emails all over again, I mean, it's very possible that the results could have been different. The thing is that if you look at the book, it's not only attacking the James Comeys and the Republicans and the Russian things like that. She does have not great things to say about Bernie Sanders. And the last thing the Democrats want is a continuation of the Hillary versus Bernie feud that we saw in 2016. We saw it at the convention, and we even saw it during the general election. So that is continuing. But she, look, you know, she deserves to be heard. She should have won. I thought she was going to win. But the Democratic Party has to decide what role, where to go. And we've seen it with Bernie Sanders calling for, you know, his kind of health care plans. The Democratic Party needs to know which direction to go in. Regarding the first thing, which was, capturing the Senate, the numbers don't look great for the Democrats. I said 33 seats are up, 25 of them are held by Democrats, and many of them of course, Sherrod Brown is in Ohio. I think he does win, but you have Claire McCaskill in Missouri, states that are pretty solidly Trump states that they have to deal with. I think the Democrats, have a good shot, or at least a decent shot, of winning back the House. They need 24 seats. Now, that sounds like a lot, but if it's a wave election, if Robert Mueller is just, you know, learning more and more things and more and indictments come and questions continue, the Democratic control of the House could be in jeopardy. I don't see it in the Senate just yet.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, he's back on a monthly basis, third Thursday of every month. So mark your calendars. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking politics this hour with veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. He'll be joining All Sides every third Thursday of the month, so mark your calendars for that. We have a Facebook message from Lucia. Ken, what's your read on how many senators are planning to vote yes on the Graham-Cassidy bill because of the September 30th deadline? Senator Grassley's recent comments seem to suggest he's won. Their calculus seems to be that the win of repealing the Affordable Care Act will be worth it when they're up for reelection, no matter the particulars. Do you think that calculus is accurate?
Well, first of all, regarding what Senator Grassley said, Senator Grassley has voted yes on every iteration of Republican health care overhaul since they've been voting this year. So Grassley's vote is not a surprise. Again, I don't think they have the votes now. I think, yes, there's a possibility if they vote no, they could go home and be faced with a Republican primary from the right. And that's the calculation many see with Dean Heller, who's thought to be jeopardized. He's the Republican from Nevada who has a pro-Trump Republican running against him. Jeff Flake, the senator from Arizona, who is going to vote yes on this, has a pro-Trump Republican voting against him in next year's primary. So there is that fear. But, of course, Susan Collins, John McCain, and Lisa Murkowski, none of those senators, none of those three senators are up in 2018. Neither is Rand Paul, who doesn't have to worry about somebody from the right, because if he votes no, he'll say it's because it was just too weak. Mm-hmm. I really think that this was just, they looked at the calendar, said, oh my goodness, September 30th is coming. It's our last chance to pass something with 50 votes, and that's why we're pushing it right now, because this didn't even exist a week ago, but I still am not convinced they vote yes on it. And yeah, Donald Trump says this is a great bill, but you know, I don't even know if Donald Trump knows what's in it. I think he just wants
a victory.
Well,
does anybody know what's in it? I mean, the Congressional Budget Office hasn't even come out with their report on it.
Exactly. And the previous one, the previous bill, which the Congressional Budget Office said would cost, you know, 23 million fewer people covered by health insurance. Mm-hmm. And yet 49 Republicans, was it 48 Republicans voted yes on it. So a lot of it is party loyalty. A lot of it is arm twisting by Mitch McConnell, the majority leader. A lot of it is threats by Donald Trump and his allies that will challenge you with a primary if you vote no. But there are still some independent souls out there who are going to take their time and vote. My guess right now is, I mean, who knows? I've been wrong on everything in my life. But my guess right now is that it does not pass.
Speaking of Mitch McConnell, where is he at right now? He has suffered some horrific losses when it comes to politics. Tell me.
I was going to say, the fact that he can still get 47, 48, 49 Republicans voting yes on a health care overhaul bill that many people think is really flawed,
yeah,
is a good job. I mean, okay. He is the ultimate arm twist. I'm sorry?
No. Yeah, okay. He's the ultimate arm twister.
Oh, he is. He's not as good as Lyndon Johnson, for example. But given the fact that you can't get these Republicans to agree on almost anything, given the ideological fractures that are in the party, we've seen it in the House as well, I think the fact that he's gotten as many as he has is a credit to Mitch McConnell. But I guess in Washington, a victory is a victory, and anything short of that is a defeat. And right now, his scorecard doesn't look as good as he would like, of course, and certainly not as good as Donald Trump would like.
Well, we kind of talked about the Pelosi-Schumer conversations with Trump and the wheeling and dealing going on there about how it reflected on them. But how does it reflect on the likes of Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell?
That's a great question. You were talking earlier about body language. It was a great scene when they were all sitting around in some White House room, and you have Paul, you have Speaker Ryan, you have Mitch McConnell, you have a grinning Chuck Schumer, and you have a smiling Nancy Pelosi, and you have a glum looking Mitch McConnell, like, oh my God, I can't believe he's working on a deal with Chuckles and Nancy. I mean, you know, but basically Trump says, look, you know, I relied on you. You promised me a repeal and you didn't deliver. Now, again, do you blame McConnell? No. Is there another Republican who could do a better job? I don't think so at mm-hmm. all. But again, a victory is a victory. And right now there's no victories.
I wanted to turn to the CBS Late Show. I'm sorry, the Emmys right now. Get a little show busy with you. CBS Late Show host Stephen Colbert hosted the Emmys this past weekend, and he had a surprise appearance by none other than the former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. Let's hear.
What really matters to Donald Trump is ratings. You got to have the big numbers. And I certainly hope we achieve that tonight. Unfortunately, at this point, we have no way of knowing how big our audience is. I mean, is there anyone who could say how big the audience is? Sean, do you know?
This will be the largest audience to witness an Emmys, period, both in person and around the world.
Wow, that really soothes my fragile ego. I can understand why you'd want one of these guys around.
We have an email from a listener. Can Ken recall anyone in an administration admitting to a lie as blatantly as Sean Spicer did at the Emmys? That was the crux of what happened that night, ultimately.
Wait, that was Sean Spicer, not Melissa McCarthy?
He wasn't as funny as Melissa McCarthy.
Well, actually, I thought he was very funny. My jaw dropped when he came out on the stage, and I laughed like everybody else. And I posted on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. I said I thought that was very funny. I didn't think the Trump jokes were especially funny. They seemed more obligatory than clever. I don't know. I just didn't think they were that funny. I thought Sean Spicer's appearance was very funny. But when I posted that on Facebook and Twitter, the response was mostly negative. Like, how dare you enjoy and glorify and celebrate somebody who simply lied to everybody for the months he was White House press secretary? And there's something to be said about that, because whatever you think about Sean Spicer's rehabilitation tour, when he was standing behind the podium, he said things that almost by any objective measure were just not true. Now, of course, he was under pressure from the White House to do that, but he would berate reporters, he would denounce reporters, he would call reporters liars. Mm-hmm. The thing about the large number of people watching the Emmys was a play on his saying that more people attended and watched President Trump's inauguration than ever before in history. Mm-hmm. We all knew that was nonsense. Even Kellyanne Conway said, well, there are alternative facts. There are alternative facts when it comes to Sean Spicer. Look, God bless him. I think he, you know, whatever he wants to do with his career, if he wants to make the rounds on the late night talk shows, that's great. But it doesn't erase the fact that as White House press secretary, you could hide the truth, as most press secretaries do, Democrats and Republicans.
Sure.
But when you're just completely outright telling untruths, it's hard to forgive and forget that quickly. But I did laugh.
Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Mark.
Hi. It is great to have Ken back. Good to hear
Thanks,
your
Mark.
Voice. And your sanity and sense of humor. All the talk about why Hillary lost, I'd like to bounce something off of you, which is that her problem was her own party. She actually ran ahead of most of her own party, I believe. Certainly Trump ran behind in 2016. Here in Ohio, Rob Portman won going away and got more votes than Trump did. And this is starting to get some attention about how the Democratic Party is hollowing out between the two coasts. And I wonder if it isn't so much Comey or the Russians or some other reason that's given as to why Hillary lost, as her own party couldn't pull her through.
Well, you know, the thing is, there seemed to be an anointment process for Hillary Clinton ever since she lost in 2008.
It just seemed like,
okay,
yeah.
In the primary to Barack Obama, of course, she was a good soldier. She was a very popular and widely admired Secretary of State. And it seemed like when she was running, well, look, just like in going into 2008, she was the odds-on favorite. Nobody saw Barack Obama coming. And in 2016, she was once again the odds-on favorite as well. But there were a lot of people who had questions about her. There were a lot of questions. I mean, we saw from the WikiLeaks, and I'm not praising WikiLeaks, but we did learn, to nobody's surprise, that the Democratic National Committee and Debbie Wasserman Schultz were behind Hillary Clinton's candidacy from the beginning, even though there were other people like Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and other Democrats who were running. So she didn't... There are so many things why I think she lost. No, I think Comey and the Russians did play a big deal. I think a lot of her own problems were instrumental as well. But remember, going into 2016, you had the two most unpopular, as far as approval ratings, presidential candidates in history. That while the negatives on Donald Trump were enormous, and I mean, when you think of Access Hollywood and the things he did during the campaign, it's mind-boggling that he was elected. Mm-hmm. But Hillary Clinton's numbers were never good to begin with either. So I don't think Bernie Sanders would have done better. I don't think any other Democrat would have done better. But Hillary Clinton had problems from the outset, and you know, you could do all the postmortems you want, but there, a lot of it had to do with the Democratic Party didn't really help her as much as they could. And ultimately, I think she ran a good campaign. She got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. But of course, that's not the way that you win in these days,
well,
you know, in this
the,
game.
There, and then there's just this larger mood of the country thing going on that's it's kind of unprecedented. That whoever, I mean, the Republicans are asking themselves the same questions that Hillary Clinton's answering about her campaign. They're all asking the same questions, too.
Remember the last time a two-term Democrat was succeeded by another Democrat, you have to go back to, you know, FDR and Truman in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. I mean, Clinton won twice, Bill Clinton won twice, but Al Gore didn't. Well, he got more votes, but he wasn't elected president. It's not easy after 8 years of one party to be succeeded by the same party. George W. Bush did it with Reagan in 1988, but it's a very rare thing. And, you know, there was a mood in the country that time for a change, as popular as Barack Obama was. Jobs were being lost. They were being shipped overseas. People were tired of politics as usual, and there was really no... I mean, I'm trying to be as charitable as I can, but there was really no newness in Hillary Clinton other than the fact that she had the opportunity to make history being the first woman, and that should not be discarded at all. But as far as policies and things like that, there was just a time for change mood in the country, and God knows there was no bigger advocate for change than Donald Trump.
Mark, thanks for that call. You know, going back to the Vietnam War documentary series by Ken Burns and Kim and Lynn Novick.
By Ken Rudin. Ken, and, right.
Did I say Ken Burns? Or Ken
no,
Rudin?
No.
Okay,
I just
now you're
to
messing
work
me up.
No,
now
no.
You're messing with
red, white, blue, okay.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. You know, when I was talking to him last week or week before last, I guess, I don't know, whenever it was, about the film and about the documentary. You know, we talked about he didn't want it compared to like, oh, back then was like now. He was more interested in the trajectory since then to now, and that it's not a parallel, but it's part of a trajectory about the mood of the country and the polarization. It kind of sort of started, or it didn't start then, but it sort of took on a certain flavor.
I do think, and there was some indications of this in the second episode of the Burns Novick series, that one person said, you know, I believed in our government, I believed in President Kennedy. President Kennedy would never lie to us, but this Vietnam did something to the psyche of this country, and that is doubts about what the government says to you, and it's clear from one of the great things it's clear from is that the government knew that there was an unwinnable war, and right. Yet we kept putting tens and thousands of more and more Americans into sending them overseas. I think there's a sense that the government lied to us, and I think starting in Vietnam and of course continuing with Watergate, there was a sense that you cannot trust the government. So when you think of when Colin Powell goes before the United Nations and says that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, now, he may not have been lying. He may have had false information, mm-hmm. you know, false intelligence information. But there's a feeling that, do we trust what the government is saying? Do we believe that's, I mean, if the Taliban, if 9/11 happened from people who came from Saudi Arabia and had a sanctuary in Afghanistan, why go into Iraq? Mm-hmm. So the questions that began in 1965 and 1966 continue this day. And I think that's a big lesson to Vietnam, that you have to, you know, as Reagan would say, trust but verify. And you didn't get that in the decision to go into Iraq.
And just the polarity of the country these days, it was very similar back then.
Oh, it absolutely was. I mean, it absolutely was. The fact is, you had 500,000 people marching down Fifth Avenue in New York. You had massive demonstrations in Washington. One big difference, I think, is the fact that there was a draft back then, and mm-hmm. I think so many people they were subject to being drafted to go to Vietnam. The people who are going to Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan now, well, not Syria, but Iraq and Afghanistan, are people who volunteer for that position. And I think that's one of the reasons you're not seeing these huge, monstrous demonstrations against the war. But if it gets worse and worse, who knows what's going to happen with North Korea? Who knows what's going to happen in the rest of the world, given the bombastic language we heard at the UN on Tuesday? So, but right now, I mean, every situation is different. I think that Vietnam, you had 500,000 Americans there at one time, and almost so many people were affected. So many families were touched by it. I don't think the effect is the same, but the only comparison I can see is the honesty of the government, and that's always been suspect.
Ken Rudin, I guess we'll talk again next month.
Wait, I'm not finished talking. I'm still talking. Oh, the show is over.
Oh, my goodness. The show is over, yes.
And as always, I love talking to you.
Love talking to you, too, Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. Ken is going to be a regular feature on All Sides with Ann Fisher every third Thursday of the month. So mark your calendars. Don't miss it. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.